Hi, everyone. My name is Natalie Gochner. This is Both Sides of the Aisle, and I represent the political center and have on the political right joining us, John Dougal.
Hey, Natalie. Great to be with you. Good to see you, Shireen.
And Shireen Gorbani on the left.
Hello, and hey to the listeners. Always appreciate you tuning in.
Lots going on. I'll just mention that we are recording virtually today. I'm up in Park City. We got both Shireen and John in different places, but we have to talk again about...
And Natalie's up there at an Olympic Village up there, and so, you know, I'm just going to say, if anybody deserves a gold medal for economics, it is Natalie.
You're kind.
You know, the president of the University of Utah, Taylor Randall, is having an alumni event up at the Utah Olympic Park tonight, and I slipped into the bobsled training room for a minute to record the program, so always good. But, you know, I don't... The top secret records that were seized at the Mar-a-Lago resort by the FBI, we talked about last week how it was the tip of the iceberg. And, you know, different things have been revealed, right? We now know what sets of documents were seized, 11 sets. They're classified, marked top secret, other kinds of markings.
Yeah, some highly sensitive.
Yeah. And, you know, we've watched how people have responded to it. Where do you see it at this point in time, Shireen? And John, I'll ask you the same question.
So I'll say, I think broadly, this is really reminiscent of kind of my feelings through much of the Trump presidency, which is just the unending sort of chaos, corruption, and just sort of waiting to see what next shoe will drop. I don't know if that feels familiar to you, but for me, you know, the news stories as they're kind of unraveling, the increasing violence that we're seeing, you know, people taking really extreme actions and the kind of rhetoric that's bubbling up online. All of this to me is just, again, the Trump legacy just back in full force. But what I would say is, I think some of the interesting things that are coming up for me are, you know, how it is that the Biden administration is responding to it. They're saying they're learning about it in real time as, you know, they have an independent Department of Justice that is out there doing this work. And, you know, we're seeing some interesting moves from Congress who are trying to create, I think, some inroads to balance and transparency. But we're also seeing some people who are absolutely continue to be, you know, spokespeople for Trump. And I have to say, I noticed Chris Stewart came out pretty hot. You know, saying there's a crisis of leadership at the FBI, going kind of on and on. And then once he kind of understood what was seized in those documents, really rolled that back quite a bit and really cooled his heels a bit on the commentary, which, you know, is I think, incredible to see for somebody who's been such an ardent defender of Trump, even after his little Mussolini commentary.
John, let's get your reaction. And I'll remind the listeners, John surprised me last week when I asked you about it, John, just initially. I thought you'd come down really hard on the FBI, but your comment was, we need more information, which I think is the reasonable place to be a week ago and even today.
Yeah, so clearly there was some concerning information that was being leaked about the seizure and what was the concern. Since then, the warrant and the inventory of what was seized was released. FBI went to the courts. Trump did not fight the release, and so we know more information about that. We currently have two senators. We have Marco Rubio, Republican from Florida, Democrat Mark Warner. They're both on the Senate Intelligence Committee. They're asking to see those records, and clearly, you know, they're classified, and so I think what their concern is this really ultra sensitive information that should never even be in the president's home, or is this more run of the mill classified information, which you might expect somebody that's of presidential level to have? I think
either
we're also going to see
you would agree this is certainly a violation of process, though.
Well, it's clearly indicative of a concern about process. And I think we're going to learn much more about process, because to the process point, my understanding is the president has pretty broad authority to declassify information. And clearly Trump is claiming he declassified it. My understanding is Congress has a process that one needs to go through if they're a president to declassify. And the question will now be, what is that information? Was it declassified? What process went through? And we're going to be learning a whole bunch like that. And I think it's critical for Congress to perform oversight when it comes to this matter.
Natalie, what are your thoughts? I mean, you said it was the tip of the iceberg. Is that how you're feeling still?
Yeah, it is. And I noticed that the Justice Department is not willing to, you know, is asking not to release, is it the affidavit that gives so much of the detail? because it would violate, you know, what they're trying to prove and that they need to protect witnesses and the like. I will say that what has not surprised me was the former president's response. It's been very shifty, calls it a hoax. He claims that he's declassified the documents. He's claimed executive privilege, attorney-client privilege. And then you had the FBI making some mistakes. I guess they took some of the former president's passports, even though they've been expired. But, you know, what were they doing taking his passports? So yeah. It's a mess. It's a mess. But if I were like trying to do the needle on this, I do not believe that the president's above the law. And I believe we have to respect our institutions and we should let this play out. And I like what the senators are doing. I like this bipartisan. We have a security clearance. We're, you know, elected representatives with this responsibility, meaning on the Senate Intelligence Committee. And let us have a look at it and then let us tell you what we see. And I think that would be a reasoned approach to help calm things down a bit.
Yeah, and calm things down is an important thing. We clearly have one man who broke into an FBI office. He had a gun and a nail gun and clearly appeared to want to do harm. And I think that's completely inappropriate in this kind of situation. I mean, we can be concerned on both sides about improprieties and allegations here and there. That kind of violence is, I think we all agree, completely inappropriate.
Mm-hmm. This is a bit philosophical, but I think it's our listeners might find it interesting. But I hate this kind of stuff where you see government in so much turmoil because it's already hard enough for people to get excited about government. You know, government taxes you, government regulates you, government takes away freedoms and things. I mean, but you've got right now this mess, you know, with the former president. He's in trouble in New York. He pled the fifth 440 times during a recent deposition. You've got the Secret Service texts that, you know, some are arguing were, you know, destroyed intentionally. I don't know. You're seeing that. You've got a Senator Lindsey Graham being asked to testify at a Georgia grand jury. And the more you have these things, the more distance you put between sort of the median voter and our elected officials. I think it's a real problem. I'm seeing you nod, Shereen.
Yeah, so you've mentioned numerous times that we're, you know, in this crisis around our institutions and that we're seeing this both decline in trust in many of our major institutions, but I think we're also seeing in some cases really the rot at the center of some of them when we think about some of these controversies, conflicts. So I agree with you because I'm really a person who believes in the possibility of government, who believes that it, you know, when done well, can truly be a force to improve people's lives, to, you know, create peace, to help people live healthier and in more communal ways. But that is not what we're seeing. And what we're seeing, in fact, is the escalation of violence. We're seeing, you know, hyper-partisanship. I think we're seeing a lot of people really feeling angry for reasons that I can understand, though the actions that we're seeing are certainly inexcusable. Mm-hmm.
Go ahead, John.
I'm going to say, I don't think we should read too much into 440 times taking the fifth. One of the key things is people have a right to avoid self-incrimination, and whether you're guilty or whether you're innocent, I don't think we should read too much into it. I know the president a few years ago indicated why would somebody who's innocent take the fifth. I am going to say
he's learning.
Hopefully from my perspective, he has learned. He has a new perspective and hopefully a better appreciation for other folks who take the fifth in various situations.
Shereen, we did get, I'm just going to go to Shereen first because it's a Democratic success, but we did get the House, Senate, and now the president signing the big bill, right? Am I got that right?
Yeah.
It's now the law of the land.
The big bill.
Yeah, this is.
Yes, the big bill. So,
the mini,
you know,
big
again,
Build Back
really,
Better bill.
That's right. The mini big Build Back Better. But what we're really seeing here again is the investment and commitment of Democrats to really show up when it comes to things like, you know, investments in renewable energy. This is a huge climate bill. And in fact, it's the biggest investment that many of us are likely to see, well, that we've ever seen really in our lifetimes. And then also thinking about the opportunities to reduce the cost of healthcare, especially for our seniors, when we're thinking about, you know, efforts that were taken to really prioritize those sort of kitchen table issues for so many Americans. I'm proud that we were able to get this work done. But I'll also say that I think it's sort of a real moment of chaos. And again, classic Trump, right? That the narrative is not at all about the successes or the ways that people are going to feel the impacts of the Inflation Reduction Act. But I hope that people will go and check it out. There have been great write-ups on it, especially as it relates to healthcare, something I'm particularly interested in. But the, you know, continued investment and the reduction of the premiums that people pay on the marketplace, the capping at $2,000 for our seniors on Medicare, the ability for Medicare to start negotiating some drug prices. All of this is really important work that is going to matter to people across the state.
Yeah. John, it'll be interesting to see how it plays in election time when you've had some major legislative successes, some bills that have passed. Those are, you know, the president will get credit for that among his supporters. And then you've got the abortion issue, and then you've got the Trump issue, and all of that is going to collide. One other point just before we take a break. I just, yesterday I was in Vernal and toured some oil and gas leases and some drilling sites. It was really interesting, and I left really hopeful. And I don't know if, we don't really have a lot of time for us to discuss it, but I interacted with people who run these oil and gas drilling rigs, and I talked to them about climate change, and they agree that it's a challenge and they want to do their best to help with it. And they were showing me all the things they're doing to get rid of leaks, to burn off things that are very polluting. And they were part of the solution. Quick reaction, John.
Well, Congressman Curtis talks a lot about how even when we talk oil and gas in the U.S., it is a lot cleaner than oil and gas around the world, and that the world would be better off and cleaner in terms of climate, if we were extracting the oil and gas here, because we're not venting, we're not doing other things like that, we're not releasing methane and so forth, like many other countries are doing. In fact, he says, I can't remember the number, it's something like we're 50% cleaner or 40% cleaner than what's going on. And in fact, The Economist just last week had an article discussing this exact topic,
yeah,
about how much, in essence, greener we are in the U.S. when it even comes to fossil fuel extraction versus around the nation or around the world.
Shereen, every well site I went to had a little sticker that said, latch the hatch. And this is their effort to close these gaps in the top of their storage units that are, you know, leaking emissions. And I thought this is really positive.
Yeah, I think we certainly should expect them to be part of the solution at this point. But I'll also say, as a person who grew up in North Dakota with ties to Western North Dakota, where we've seen the Bakken oil explosion and the real boom in activity and fracking there, those are landscapes that are never coming back. And they have been, you know, forever changed and degraded because of this, you know, extractive industry. And that'll break my heart forever.
Let's take a break here. I'm Natalie Gochner with John Dougal and Shereen Gurbani. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle on KCPW. For more episodes of all our in-house podcasts, click on the Local Programs tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider donating to KCPW to support public radio in your community.
Shereen Gurbani on the left.
John Dougal on the right.
Natalie Gochner, I'm in the political center, and this is Both Sides of the Aisle. We want to move to some local news, but just quickly before we do that, John, 1 year anniversary of the U.S. leaving Afghanistan. What do you think in retrospect?
I still have concerns about how we left, and my concerns rest with both President Trump and President Biden. I think mm-hmm. they both mismanaged the incident. I think we needed to get out of there. I think we needed to do it in a smart way. And 1 year later, my opinion hasn't changed.
Mm-hmm. Shereen?
You know, I continue to be heartsick that we have girls that are unable to go to high school, that we're seeing further restrictions in women's lives. And then we're also seeing the presence of some truly heinous leaders in terrorist movements, really having, it seems like, a free rein in movement in some of these spaces. I think it's a terrifying situation. It must be a terrifying situation on the ground, especially if you're a young woman.
So there's no easy transition to talking about what's going on with the bill that Representative Phil Lyman is talking about. This is a Republican from Blanding. I know Representative Lyman. He's mostly known for what he does in public land issues. But he wants to remove a carve-out in Utah's child protection laws that allows clergy members not to report suspected child abuse. This is coming from the AP reporting, I believe it was, about an LDS bishop in Arizona who did not report some really awful, awful, awful child abuse that happened over multiple generations and I don't know, just an
was not required, was not required to report and did not report.
Uh-huh. And I guess, John, jump in if you know this differently, but Utah does not have that requirement currently.
No, there's an allowance for the clergy not to report those type of incidents. I think it's intended so the clergy can work with those in their congregation to try and help mitigate and deal with those kind of situations on the multiple parties that are impacted.
Uh-huh. And the concept being that you're exempted because you're in a ministerial capacity that's dealing with sin and repentance and those sorts of things. But my goodness, this is something I would have an easy time supporting Representative Phil Lyman on. Shireen?
Yeah, and I just want to direct listeners for whom this might be a very triggering story or something that, you know, taps into their own experience to the Utah Domestic Violence Coalition. So that's udvc.org is a place where you can go and find resources for family members or for individuals who have experienced abuse.
Mm-hmm. Shireen, go ahead, John.
And I think, Natalie, I think Shireen and I both agree that, you know, you look at the situation that was reported in that story, and I think we agree that certain steps should have been taken, whether or not the law required it, to help make sure the victim was protected in the situation when, you know, the bishop became aware of the concern. And it seemed like he was dealing with the perpetrator more than making sure the victim was protected.
Yeah, yeah. Just a really tragic situation. John and Shireen, it's back to school time. Shireen, I know you have an education family. I believe your husband teaches school. Am I getting that right?
He's not a teacher anymore. He actually left education. And I will say a special shout out to all the teachers there. We're hearing lots about, you know, the strain that we're having on in our own state to find people to fill numerous roles. Teachers are seeing lots of posts about people going back to school and really struggling in the profession just because it has been such a stressful time over the pandemic and then through this last year.
Yeah. John, I'm in the Murray School District. Our school district started back this week, but it's always a tipping point in the late summer, early fall when people go back to school. But we also have a free lunch program that looks like it's not funded at the levels that at least Shireen would like, John.
Yeah. I mean, it's going back, my understanding is it's going back to be funded and provided in the level it was before the pandemic. So during the pandemic, it was basically expanded to pretty much every student, and now it's going back to those that meet certain criteria in terms of low income.
Okay,
yeah,
Shireen.
And what we know is that this is the place where a lot of our kiddos get fed. It's one of the reasons that there are a number of advocates who work through the summer tirelessly to make sure that we have kids connected to meal resources. And you know, it's something like an additional 10 million kids who were able to access meals free during the pandemic. And there are states that are moving in this direction. California, I think Minnesota has done a pretty generous expansion as well. We don't always know what families are going through. They don't always have the wherewithal, the resources or the ability to go through the paperwork that's necessary to be determined eligible for free lunch. And then we also have seen, even in our own state, some really, in the past, ugly situations where kids are denied meals because they're behind on, you know, paying for school lunch. So I would just suggest that if, you know, people wanted to get active and advocate, this would be a great thing to see our legislature do if they claim to be as, you know, pro-family and pro-child as they say they are. Let's implement some of these programs that really expand access to nutrition security for our kids across the state.
And this is where I'll nuance it a little bit, Natalie, which is, first of all, I don't think the federal government should be in this kind of a program. This is not a federal issue. Now, to Shireen's point, it could be a state issue, but this is one of those things. To what extent should our schools be in the education business, and to what extent should they be in all sorts of other things, including feeding kids? And, you know, it was breakfast, or it was lunch, and now it's breakfast, and is it, you know, dinner? Is it going to be, you know, weekends? Is it, you know, where does it end? And I think first and foremost, education needs to focus on doing the education stuff.
Kids can't learn if they haven't eaten. And also the USDA runs this program, so the Department of Agriculture, and there's a big tie-in to local, you know, farmers and local chains of distribution that are part of this as well.
I'll admit there's a whole bunch of cronyism between this well-intended program and farmers and corporations and stuff out there.
So John thinks kids shouldn't eat and he's against farmers. Got it.
Well, I think it's not a federal issue and we got cronyism going on.
I think
both of those are bad policies.
Yeah, that's hard. You know, John, of the things that the federal government does in education, this one is probably about my favorite.
Yeah.
because it deals with a basic, basic need. But I understand what you're saying, that why wouldn't you take care of this, administer this, you know, whatever, do it at a state level and not have it be federal policy. But I will say it does a lot of good, because you have a lot of socioeconomically disadvantaged children that get their only cold milk and, you know, hot meals and different things from the school lunch program. So,
yeah.
Hey, I wanted to just bring up another issue and just kind of think about it that relates to kids again. Shireen, we'll start with you. The Utah GOP has called for a ban on elective gender-affirming medical care for minors. This is transgender care.
Yeah. So this is, you know, to me, I guess a couple of things come to mind. One is I think about the families, you know, that have kids, kids that I know who are trans that have, you know, gone through this process. They're doing it in deep consultation with healthcare providers, with their families, with, you know, a support system around them. This is not something that happens to kids. This is something that families go through together. And I think the language that came out in the news article from the state GOP chair really, to me, suggests a person who doesn't really understand what this kind of care looks like. I would also say it's a continuation of a pattern that we're seeing from Republicans in our state to get deeply involved in personal private healthcare decisions. You know, abortion certainly being top of mind for me, but when we think about other kinds of care, and John, I know you've even expressed a concern, you know, is when we think about procedures or things that people may be going through to help their fertility may also be kind of caught up in some of the fervor and really I think the you know, political moment where we're seeing politics really take the driver's seat on what are healthcare issues. And I will say again that I guess the last piece that just is weighing on me so hard is to imagine having the kind of power that Republicans have in our state and to spend hours on a Saturday afternoon debating whether or not reference to furries should be included in this, you know, a resolution or not. And to have our leadership sign on to it, to me, suggests just a really, If I had this kind of power, you would not see me spending my afternoons targeting trans kids. I'd be working on some of the bigger issues that I think, you know, really touch our lives, improving our access to education, improving education, maybe even funding a school lunch program, something like that.
John, let's get your voice in here.
Well, I think I was not at the meeting, so I don't know the debate and discussion that took place. But prior to the meeting, some of the things I heard going on were concerns about children who would get some type of surgery and then change their mind later on. And so in essence, they weren't adults making informed decisions. It was, you know, uninformed children, yes, perhaps with their families, but families feeling like, you know, my kid wants to do this and going along with it and being concerned about that. But the other concern that I heard from various folks that were attending this meeting was, okay, if we believe in parental rights, at what point does the government step in? At what point does the government not? And the classic one that they kept referring to was then vaccines. Are we going to hit a point in which the parents can no longer say, hey, I'm not going to vaccinate my kid. The government is going to administer a vaccine and they're going to trump the parental rights. And so there was kind of two back and forth going on leading into this meeting.
Natalie, I'll just what's your read on it?
Yeah, yeah, I'll say from the political middle, I serve on the Primary Children's Hospital Board. I've had briefings from the board, you know, physicians at the hospital about services provided to transgender youth. I think that the GOP should listen to medical experts and put the trust in families. I think that's the right public policy here. I don't think this is in the domain of government per se. Well, you guys, we got to end the program. I want to end by talking about monkeypox. You know, you can talk about how it's, you know, we're seeing more cases and should we have, you know, different public health measures taken. But I really want to talk about the name. Pressure's growing for a new name for the disease. Critics say it's misleading. I guess monkeys are not the original animal host. A group of leading scientists wrote a position paper. They said, we need a name that's neutral, non-stigmatizing, non-discriminatory. So, John, Shireen, what do you think? Get a new name?
Get a new name. I, of course, also here with the information, letting you know that your local health department is the place that you can go if you're looking for the vaccine or looking for information on that. If you have a primary health care provider, you could also talk to them. But it is a misleading name. And there's been a lot, you know, said, I think, about the way that we're talking about this more broadly in media and really the misleading nature of it. Let's change the name.
Yeah. John, would you be there?
I'm going to say that cat's probably out of the bag right now. Maybe they want to think about how they name these things in the first place and the next disease that comes along. But no matter what they change it to, I think people are probably latched in. They're going to keep calling it monkeypox.
I guess they, it's the World Health Organization that names viruses, these things. They do it with a technical committee, but I'm all for changing the name. I would look for a very clinical kind of name that we can all feel better about. So,
I think.
Please don't make it. Don't make it COVID 2020.
Well, that's right. But I also think things change, right? It happened with coronavirus, COVID-19, COVID. Yeah. Like, we can change. Let's do it.
Let's do it. Well, this has been a great discussion. I'm Natalie Gochner with John Dougal and Shireen Gourbani. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Anthony Scoma produces the program. We hope you join us next week as well.